This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
As The Economist reports, the top 0.1% of America's population have as much wealth as the bottom 90% of the rest of the people. No wonder some hope this elite will finally turn towards saving what's left of the planet. Do the billionaires know? Some do. There's talk about Richard Branson and his $3 billion pledge to combat climate change. Branson and other bigwigs like Warren Buffett and T. Boone Pickens credit another fellow billionaire for their turn towards green thought and action, and that would be the unsung radical rich man Ted Turner, founder of CNN, among other things. There's a new book out, Last Stand, Ted Turner's Quest to Save a Troubled Planet. From Bozeman, Montana, we have the author and longtime environmental journalist Todd Wilkinson on the line. Todd, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
It's a pleasure to be here, Alex.
Well, I've been looking forward to this conversation. Why don't we start with this? In case there's anyone out there who doesn't know, how did Ted Turner become a multi-billionaire?
Well, Ted Turner is an American businessman who fundamentally relates to the world from the point of view of an underdog. He prevailed when many people sold him short. He won, for example, the America's Cup yachting race when people said he could never win. His big accomplishment, however, was creating a thing called the Superstation in the late 70s, when he hooked up an old backwater cable TV channel to a satellite and created this media enterprise that could reach around the world. But most notably, he founded CNN, the 24-hour news channel, when many people said that launching that would be a disaster and that society had no appetite for 24-hour news. So shortly after he did that in 1980, he began also buying a number of other media enterprises, movie studios, and so on. And he used that content to load up his cable channels, and it created an incredible amount of value. And thus, he was able to build this media empire. He also owned the Atlanta Braves baseball team, which he turned into a World Series contender, and ultimately they won the World Series. And so all of these properties together under the banner of Turner Broadcasting turned Ted from this entrepreneur into a billionaire.
And even as he was a capitalist on his way into that wealth stratosphere, he still had a yearning to protest the system, as you say. And I know that in the 1990s, he was a big supporter of Greenpeace USA. And then he funded something called the Ruckus Society. They trained young people to climb trees or block bulldozers. How could a capitalist quietly fund people who protest against capitalist pollution?
Well, Ted is someone who really believes in free speech. He believes that we need to fully hear people and listen to what they have to say. Two little stories I'd like to share, if you don't mind. One is that during the time when Ted was building original content, he, for example, enlisted Jacques Cousteau to create documentaries about the problems facing the ocean. During that time, he also greenlighted a documentary that looked at the effects of clear-cutting. And when about the time that piece was going to air, timber companies threatened to boycott his stations and say they would withdraw their advertising. And in fact, Turner refused to back down and said, you know, we're not only going to run that documentary once this week, we're going to run it as often as I like. And so he never backed down. And what he proved is that by having integrity and not capitulating to the major advertisers, that the public would respond, and indeed they did. Another story is that when he was at the Davos Economic Summit, standing with Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General of the UN, Turner was looking out at protesters who were protesting, you know, the growing chasm between the haves and the have-nots within wealthy countries. And Anand said, Ted, you need to step back from the window because they may throw rocks. And Ted said, you know what? We need to go out and understand why they'd want to throw rocks at us. And so Ted actually went down after the meeting and met with people and spoke with them. And so he really believes that we need to do a better job as a society in listening to all people.
Now, in writing your book, The Last Stand, you had a chance to sit down and talk with Ted Turner. Did he explain how an Atlanta businessman found his way to environmentalism?
Well, Ted grew up, he had a very traumatic childhood, and I get into that in detail in the book. In fact, that's sort of the key to understanding the psyche of Ted Turner. He grew up, he was sent off to boarding school at an early age. His father was emotionally distant and abusive, and indeed, when Ted was 24 years old, his father took his own life. And so Ted grew up, he always had this profound bond with nature and the natural world. And as Jane Fonda, his wife of 10 years, said, that Ted's attempts to try and save the world are really an attempt to try and save himself.
And we could say Turner did put his money where his mind is. Let's start with rewilding. That's a concept pushed by the Radical Green and monkey wrencher Dave Foreman. What is Ted doing about rewilding?
Well, you know, rewilding, when you consider it within the context of conservation, it isn't really that radical. There's been a lot of talk in North America about post-Pleistocene rewilding. And a very concrete example of that is that Ted has led an effort to bring back plains bison to his ranches. He owns about 15 ranches. He has a total bison herd of about 55,000 animals. And he bought these old ranches that were really beaten up. They'd been overgrazed with cattle. Ted kicked the cattle off the ranches and brought back bison. And he's used those as ecological tools to heal abused soils and grasslands. And one of the most notable things in all of this is that where you have bison, these large native ungulates, once popular, 35 million strong across North America, where you have those animals are also more predator resistant. And so on a couple of Ted's properties, he has wolves and grizzly bears. In fact, on his flagship ranch, the Flying D Ranch near Bozeman, where I live, he has one of the largest wolf packs in the lower 48 that's taken up residence right in the middle of the ranch. And it was always his dream to bring wolves back. And he today is able to stand outside on his back porch from his house and howl to wolves in the night, and they've answered him, and he's done that with people ranging from Richard Branson to former President Jimmy Carter and, the prominent scientist E.O. Wilson.
Well, you know, bringing back wolves and even grizzly bears isn't going to be popular with all the other Montana ranchers. What have you heard about his relationship with the Montana rancher community?
Well, you know, initially, Ted really insulted the cattle industry when he started booting cattle off of his ranches. He made some insulting comments. He said that, you know, cattle were less hygienic than bison and that they trash streams more and all of that. You know, he, over the years, has had to realize that with any creature on a landscape, you have to steward it and, in some cases, manage it. What Ted has done is he's tried not to be heavy-handed. He doesn't believe in managing bison as domestic livestock at all. That's anathema to him. And so he has, over the years, I think, repaired some of the early damage that was there when he came into the West and really cast aspersions at the livestock industry. And if you talk to people today, they appreciate the fact that Ted Turner has put conservation easements on some of his major ranches, which means that they will never be subdivided and carved up. In the West today, there's growing pressure related to human development and sprawl overtaking former wild country. And Ted's done a lot of things to make sure, at least on his own property, that never happens.
Yeah, you know, traveling through the USA, I often wonder who owns those wide open spaces. Often it's the military or the government agency, the Bureau of Land Management, but it may be Ted Turner. How much land does he have?
Well, he has around 2 million acres. That makes him the second largest private property owner in America. And the interesting thing that in the U.S., as in Canada, most of the developed and settled parts of the West lie in the river valleys. And so, again, in the U.S., as in Canada, we all have access to a lot of public land, but it's often those private landscapes that really tether together the big, wild public landscapes. And when you have species that migrate over long distances, be it elk or mule deer or pronghorn or other species, and then you have predators that roam widely, such as grizzly bears and wolves, you know, they need to have access to all aspects of the landscape. And so private land conservationists play a key role in being able to accommodate these species. And it's becoming ever more crucial in this era of climate change when, you know, landscapes, the bigger the better for these large, wide-ranging animals.
Now, some people have told me Turner's still a capitalist, maybe an eco-capitalist with these ventures. I mean, documentary producer Michael Moore claimed Turner's land has a higher gross domestic product than the country of Belize. And he doesn't just raise bison, he slaughters them too for the meat he sells in Ted's Montana grill chain. Is it sort of the case that everything has to pay its way as he goes with Ted?
You know, absolutely. The one thing that I subjected Turner to was a lot of scrutiny. I wanted to ensure as I was doing this research that Turner wasn't an example of greenwashing. And I should point out, he does not believe that we are going to consume our way to prosperity or a safer and better world. In fact, he subscribes to the principles of what some call the triple bottom line, which is, indeed, conservation, if it's going to persist, it needs to pay for itself. We can't pass on stewardship as this insurmountable debt proposition to our heirs. And so Ted believes that things have to pay for themselves. But another key tenet of the triple bottom line is the belief that if you are going to do development activity, you either do no harm, you minimize your harm, or in the case of Ted Turner, you take whatever profits you do and you do it to heal past abuses that existed before you took ownership. So he does that. And then the third leg is the human component. And that is that you pay the people who work for you a decent living wage, and you also keep all of your money in local communities. Instead of sending it away to distant boardrooms, you try to channel it into the local communities near your properties. And initially, while there were some people who were anxious about Turner coming into the backyard, today in all of these rural communities, you will find people who are grateful that Ted channels his money back into those communities, and the money both trickles down and it trickles up.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with Todd Wilkinson, author of Last Stand, Ted Turner's Quest to Save a Troubled Planet. The Texas billionaire T. Boone Pickens came out with a vision to reduce America's carbon footprint. Talk to us about Ted Turner's influence on Pickens and other billionaires.
So in recent years, Ted Turner and T. Boone Pickens have gone on the equivalent of a barnstorm. And Ted got to know T. Boone Pickens during the days when, you know, Boone was a fairly controversial but well-known takeover expert of other companies. And so they became friendly, and they both liked to hunt and fish. And so they've gone on the road together, and Ted has convinced Pickens to realize that climate change is real. And so they both think about natural gas as being a potential bridge fuel. Turner, if he had his druthers, would abolish the use of coal immediately. Pickens, on the other hand, is this old fossil fuel oil guy, this wildcatter who built his fortune that way. And by being out on the road together, Pickens has realized that natural gas needs to be used as a bridge fuel. he has been a major proponent of shifting away from oil. And it's this dynamic relationship that the two gentlemen have. Pickens not only credits Turner with getting him to think differently about the importance of fossil fuels as it shapes climate, but he credits Ted Turner with using CNN as a tool for giving North Americans an opportunity to look into the former USSR, and people in Russia at the same time were able to see outward. And Pickens credits Turner with helping to bring down the Berlin Wall.
That's a big gift. And I think he did form part of that. I can remember being in various countries of the world, and I'd tune into CNN to find out what was going on. On his website, tedturner.com, there's a long list of solar projects built by Ted Turner. He has a whole subsidiary devoted to it. And just one example, his Campo Verde solar facility in Imperial County, California, can produce 139 megawatts. I did a little checking, Todd, and found that's larger than the rated capacity of over 200 coal generating stations in the United States. So this isn't a small plant. Talk to us about Ted Turner and solar power.
So Ted Turner often has been asked to go before leading business schools, and when he's talking to MBAs, people say, Ted, if you had to do it all over again, how would you make your next billion? And he says, we need to think systematically in how we're going to make the switch away from fossil fuels. And Ted says, if he were to do it again, he would have made major investments in alternative renewable energy, wind and solar. And so he wants to lead by example. In fact, he's told me on several occasions he wants to be able to go and testify before Congress as a farmer of the sun. And he wants to show that it can be done. And so he's formed partnerships with these large energy conglomerates that traditionally have been all about coal. And so in some of these ventures, they've built these vast solar arrays, and his goal is to provide enough power by the end of this decade drawn from the sun that will fuel over 100,000 homes in the United States. And so, you know, Turner doesn't just talk the talk, he walks the walk. And again, when I was writing the book, I subjected Ted to scrutiny. We had a lot of intense conversations. And he does want to do what's right. He also, it should be noted, he flies around in his own jet.
Right. I would think that he would. He would have a high footprint himself, but he is building these solar plants, so we'll give him some credit for that. And he's also concerned about nuclear weapons, and he got Warren Buffett involved. What does his anti-nuclear foundation do? Do you know?
Well, the Nuclear Threat Initiative was co-founded by Ted Turner and former U.S. Senator Sam Nunn. And Sam Nunn and Ted today think that there are two major threats facing the world. One is the existence and continuance of missiles pointed at America from Russia, the U.S. back at Russia, over 4,000 nuclear warheads apiece, all on hair trigger alert and, you know, subject to computer malfunction. We could have nuclear catastrophe that way. But a bigger concern even is what happened to all of that former nuclear material, the fissile material, highly enriched uranium and plutonium that existed in those old missile and weapons labs in the former Soviet Union. And so Ted founded the Nuclear Threat Initiative to try and get a handle and secure that loose fissile material. In fact, there have been some very close calls. And as Graham Allison, a noted professor at Harvard's Kennedy School, has said, you know, the terrorists on 9/11, their first choice wasn't to fly jet aircraft into the World Trade Center. It was to get their hands on a suitcase nuke and detonate it in New York City. And so I open up one of the chapters in my book with a hypothetical scenario of what would happen if a 10-kiloton bomb, also called a Sidewinder, were detonated in Times Square in New York? And Ted, at one point, helped pay for a commando raid that was never publicized very much. It happened during the Bush administration to go and secure some of this loose fissile material in the former Soviet Union and get to it before terrorists got their hands on it.
Wow. Is Turner money flowing into other green groups?
So Ted Turner has supported over 3,500 different green groups. They range across the spectrum. He is particularly interested in promoting equality for women. As you know, he gave what was then a record $1 billion in support of the United Nations in the late 1990s. And he at the same time leaned on fellow plutocrats and said, listen, I'm ashamed of you. I'm ashamed of me. We should all be ashamed together. The Forbes magazine lists the richest people in America. And how do we get on that list? We get on the list by hoarding money. We need to give back. And Forbes ought to launch a list that recognizes those who give back. And indeed, the magazine under pressure did, and it affected the behavior of Bill and Melinda Gates and Warren Buffett and others, to the point that a number of notable people have signed the Giving Pledge, in which they say they'll give away at least half of their wealth before they die. And related back to domestically, the Turner Foundation, again, of the 3,500 groups, he's given away somewhere north of $360 million. And he believes, again, that people getting involved in their communities, no matter what their route is to environmental concern, it's all good.
Now, according to Wikipedia, quote, in 2008, Turner asserted on PBS's Charlie Rose television program that if steps are not taken to address global warming, most people would die and the rest of us will be cannibals. What did Ted Turner tell you about climate change? And beyond his solar projects, what do you think he's doing about it?
Well, he's doing a number of things, but to get to the cannibal quote, Ted is an expert at sometimes riling people and saying things to get people's attention. You know, the noted writer and climate change activist Tim Flannery has called Turner one of the most important thinkers on the planet for integrated thinking. And as Flannery told me in an interview, if we don't get our handle on climate change, it is going to affect food supplies as the global population goes from 7 billion somewhere into the neighborhood of 10, maybe 11 billion by the end of this century. And that when people don't have food, I mean, the worst case scenario in a time of strife is they turn on each other. Perhaps the cannibal quote was a bit of an embellishment, but Ted said it to make the point. So what is he doing with regard to climate change? He's trying to push companies to get off of coal and move away from fossil fuels. He has affected the behavior of the National Restaurant Association, one of the most conservative entities in America. It has over a million members, 13 million employees. It's gotten them to move toward recycling waste or reducing waste, to reducing water consumption, all sorts of things. That's a systemic thing. Another thing that Ted Turner has been working with is a company like Walmart. And so two notable examples, while Ted is a believer in shopping at mom and pop shops, he does know that the kids who were the children of Sam Walton, who today preside over the company, and two things that he's done is he's gotten Walmart to come on board with sustainable fisheries, for example. And so to only buy fish that are managed in a sustainable way, that's a huge thing. The other thing that they're doing is Walmart is adopting a thing toward its packaging, which has huge implications for forests and recycling, in which it is now pushing to use only material that can be recycled seven times. When it reaches that seventh phase, it gets ground up into pulp and then is, you know, recycled there. But Turner is pushing and he's affecting corporate behavior. And as he says, unless we change business as usual, it's going to be game over.
Well, you know, most of our listeners, or many of our listeners, are suspicious of super rich white men talking about greening the planet. And I'm worried about depending on green capitalism as a solution to our problems. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, so there's a American named Doug Peacock, who's a great agitator. And Doug Peacock formed the basis for Edward Abbey's character, Hayduke, you know, a great monkey wrencher. And as Peacock told me, he said, if, you know, we're going to rely upon a bunch of rich billionaire jerks to save the world, we're hosed. And what I said to Doug Peacock, it's true. But unless we get these people into the game, unless we change the way that we do business, unless we scale down consumption, there is not going to be any hope. And so wishful thinking only goes so far. Unless we get the business community to adopt a different model, unfortunately, capitalism as we know it isn't going away anytime soon. And so what we need are people who represent crucial and profound pivot points. And I think Turner represents that. And the reason I wrote Last Stand is it's sort of an adventure book. I think it takes people on a journey. And I think that Ted Turner provides an example for young people and others to say, listen, if he can do it, why can't you do it? So if we're going to have a revolution in how business is done, we need to have tangible examples that demonstrate how it's done. And short of that, we're never going to get out of this rut. You know, we're stuck in a position of near paralysis. And Turner represents what the noted population expert Paul Ehrlich said, a meme. Just as species have memes that predestine them to survival or extinction, so too does society have memes that by the activities we pursue either doom us to collapse or allow us to persist. And I think Turner represents a true way of thinking about sustainability, and that's the whole reason behind the book.
The book is Last Stand, Ted Turner's Quest to Save a Troubled Planet. We've been talking with the author, Todd Wilkinson. Todd, I appreciate you getting in touch and telling us about this fascinating character.
Well, thank you, and keep up the good work.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. In this second half of the program, we're going to hear about an answer to ecological despair from the noted author and philosopher Kathleen Dean Moore. We have a guest interview from Orion Magazine. I'll follow up with another view from the author and owl biologist Tim Fox.
This is Scott Gast, an editor at Orion Magazine, and I'm speaking today with Kathleen Dean Moore, author of The Rules of the River. It's in the Lay of the Land department of the September-October 2014 issue of Orion. Kathleen is the author of many books and an editor of the recent anthology Moral Ground, Ethical Action for a Planet in Peril. Welcome, Kathleen.
Thank you, Scott.
So in your piece in the new issue, you develop an extended metaphor for the problem of climate change and how it might be addressed. I was hoping you could set the scene just a bit and describe the moment when you realized you had a really powerful metaphor on your hands.
Sure. I'm in Alaska. It's midnight. It's June. It's 93 degrees, if you can imagine that. It is so hot in this little black cabin that I have taken my clothes off and I'm lying on the bunk just slapping mosquitoes and dripping sweat. And I finally get up, put some clothes on, and wander down to the river. I know I'm not going to sleep. At that point, I had come there to think about climate change, and it wasn't going well. That week's heat was breaking all-time records. So there I am at the river. This is the East Fork of the Toklat River. It's a good half mile across, and it is storming along with meltwater, banging around, surging into these swells. And I say to myself, you know, this is just like climate change. How could we ever stop a river like that? It was pretty exciting because what happened then was that a chunk of the riverbank fell out and roared down the river and got lodged against a stone. And I looked at that obstruction, and I saw that it had slowed the current. It had turned the current back against itself, and behind that obstruction, the river was flowing upstream. And I looked at all the rocks there in the river, and I could see that every single obstacle had reversed the change of the current, had made it lose energy so it couldn't carry its load. The whole force of the river, when there was an obstacle there, was creating a new landscape. So I thought, this is a metaphor, isn't it? You know, I threw a rock in the river and I started to grin because we are caught up in this river. And it is rushing towards this hot, stormy, dangerous planet. And the river is powered by huge amounts of money invested in reckless corporations doing things that are harmful to the world. And we all feel helpless. How could we ever dam the flood? But then I realized, you know, we don't have to stop the river. Our work is to make a deflection in the river. One small deflection in complacency, or a small obstruction to profits, or a blockage to business as usual, and that with these small efforts, we can change the energy of the river. So I felt really much better about our prospects at that point. I thought, you know, this is the work of creative disruption. We are rocks in the river. It's the work of the radical imagination. It's the work of witness. It's ways of obstructing the flow so that it changes direction.
You've told versions of this story in person, I know, to audiences, to activists, to friends. I'm curious, what sort of reaction do you tend to get in those environments?
Yes, I have told it many places, and you have to know there's a lot of despair out there. I'm sure you know that. Fossil fuels are really tangled up in these structures of profit and violence all around the world, and people are feeling that they are only one person and they can't make any difference. So the metaphor is really very empowering. It isn't true that we're only one person and we can't make a difference. In fact, everything every one of us does makes a difference. That's how change happens, piece by piece, stone by stone. You know, there's not a single one of us who has to take all the burden on our shoulders. None of us is working alone. We don't have to solve every problem at once. And so people can go back to work again, feeling that they are part of this historic change and that they have a particular job to do. It's deeply empowering. It brings them back to the table.
Your story reminds me of something that Sandra Steingraber, another friend and longtime Orion writer, has said, which is, we are all members of a great human orchestra, and it's now time to play the Save the World Symphony. You don't have to play a solo, but you do have to know what instrument you hold and find your place in the score. I've always loved that metaphor and find myself sharing it with others all the time. And I'm curious, what do you feel is the role of stories like yours and like Sandra's when it comes to understanding how each of us can or should act to address a problem as big as climate change?
That's a beautiful, strong metaphor, just like Sandra. I'm so glad that you brought it up. And a couple of things about it I think are really important. One is this advice to know what instrument you hold. You know, if you want to know what your work is in the world, it's really important to know what you're able to do. The first question I suppose we should ask ourselves as activists is, what am I good at? What's my gift? Or Frederick Buechner said it a different way. He said, if you want to know what your calling is, you'll find it at the intersection of your greatest joy and the world's deepest needs. That's a liberating and a joyous idea. What do you love to do? Figure that out. What are you good at? And then put that to work at what you care about more than anything else. So I think Sandra's giving really good advice. At one point, I might differ with her, though, when she says, you know, find your place in the score. Because what's really exciting, what's absolutely hair-raising about this struggle, is that there is no score. We're making it up as we go along. Nobody has yet written the Save the World Symphony. It's not classical music. What we're engaged in is jazz. And that's why it is so energizing. That's why it is so scary. And that's why it is so much fun.
The first time I read your piece, I was struck by how personal it felt. It felt to me as though you were addressing each reader individually, and I found that to be part of what makes the piece so powerful. And yet, at the same time, there's always been a somewhat pernicious strand of environmentalism that advocates for taking small steps. You know, if each of us would only recycle, buy more energy-efficient appliances, buy a Prius, we'll all solve this problem. And I know that's not what you're speaking to with your piece, but I was hoping you could say something about that distinction between the language of small steps and the real significant importance of individuals making long-lasting, serious decisions about how to live differently.
Yeah, that's a good question. Is it small personal steps in our personal lives, or is it movement building in the public sphere? So what's causing climate change? Is it these small decisions that we all make, all the decisions we make about what we eat and what we drive and how we travel and where we work? Or is it these big decisions made by these big CEOs who are making big profits and using them to buy big politicians and regulators who will give them everything they need? You know, clearly it's both. So we have to do both. And so on the one hand, we have to do the small things, right? We have to make these responsible decisions at every point, or else we will be sucked into carrying Big Oil's banner. If we don't make those responsible decisions, we're going to be suckered into being foot soldiers in the fossil fuels war against the world. So we have to say, no, in my personal life, I won't eat beef. I won't buy plastic toys. I won't actually buy a Prius. I will buy a bicycle. I won't invest in coal and gas. I don't believe in it, and I won't be part of it. So yes, they're small decisions, but they define who they are. And what it amounts to, I think, is conscientious objection to this war against the world. Hell no, I won't go there. So I really am one of those people who believes in small things. But at the same time as I'm taking responsibility for my decisions, I'm not going to let Big Oil, even while they're externalizing all their other costs, externalize on me the moral shame of what they're doing to the earth. This is this great achievement, isn't it, of Big Oil to make us blame ourselves for climate change? You know, we say, oh, we've met the enemy and it's us. And we take on this terrible, paralyzing burden of shame. And we say to ourselves, until I am perfectly pure, I can't criticize Big Oil. I don't buy it. I'm not the one who's building the infrastructures that force people to use fossil fuels. And I'm not out there bribing politicians. And I'm not out there killing alternative energy programs. I'm not out there defanging regulatory agencies. Even while we're taking these small steps in our lives, we have to be disrupting, complicating Big Oil's life in every way we know how. That's about direct action. That's about politics. It's about voting. It's about blockades. And it's about stopping trains. It's about building the movement. So there's no either or about this at all. This is the biggest undertaking any of us will ever face, and we have to do both.
And it's kind of a multi-pronged undertaking, too, because part of what your river metaphor calls for is a kind of three-part action. A disruption, the creation of opportunity for new ways of living, and then finally the flourishing of those new ways. And something about that feels really true to how we experience the world. It does seem that change happens that way. And I'm hoping you can point toward a model of this working out in the world, a historical story of change that follows that pattern.
I can. The underlying assumption of that whole sequence, three-step sequence, is a good idea drives out a bad one. And so inventing new ways of doing things, better ways, is itself an act of disruption. So I'm here in Alaska, and a couple winters ago, an avalanche took out Juneau's power supply, took out their connection to their hydro. And so they had to generate electricity by burning diesel. The result was that electricity costs were five times what people were used to paying. And overnight, Juneau found a way to achieve a 40% reduction in their use of power. Now, that created a huge space for people to think, what are all the different ways that I can conserve energy? What are all the alternative ways that I can heat my home or light my restaurant? It was a marvelous exercise in imagination. And the result is now that people are very well educated in Juneau about alternative energies. So there's an example of where an avalanche was the disruption that's prompted this imagining. So our question is, how can we make these avalanches? You know, how can we make these great disruptions that require new ways of thinking and new ways of acting?
It occurred to me as I read your piece that not only is ecology and, in this case, hydrology, a good source of lessons about how the world works, but that it might also be a way of understanding how activism works. And I'm wondering, do you think it's right to say that there's kind of an ecology of activism in which some of us do the obstructing, others find the new opportunities, and others kind of build from there?
I like that quite a lot, because ecology is about interdependence, isn't it? It's about this complicated woof and the warp that weaves a system that's mutually nourishing, you know, a system that's whole and long-lasting and oftentimes very beautiful. And so every piece in an ecosystem is necessary to the whole, and every whole is necessary to every piece. So I really like this notion of an ecology of activism where we all have different roles to play. What you say makes me think about the link of that question to the metaphor of the grassroots movement. It makes me think about the ecology of these age-old prairie grasslands. People despair because we don't have a climate movement that might be more like, say, a great oak, right? This towering leader that sucks up all the nutrients and sends them out into these few strong branches. People say we need a big leader and a single movement. But let us follow Paul Hawkins' lead and celebrate the grassroots. You know, he points out in Blessed Unrest that we have a million, many millions of organizations that are all working for social and environmental justice. He calls it the biggest movement in the history of civilization. Each of us, each organization we belong to, doing what we do best and magnifying the efforts of the others. So when I'm on the road and I'm speaking to climate action people, I ask them to indicate to me by pumping their fist in the air how many of these organizations they belong to, 4, 5, 6, 7, all of them working together. It is remarkable what's happening out there. And it is an ecology, I think, of activism.
Kathleen, thank you very much. This is Scott Gast speaking with Kathleen Dean Moore, author of The Rules of the River, which appears in the September-October 2014 issue of Orion.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks for listening to the Orion podcast, and thanks to David James Duncan for the music that accompanies this podcast.
Follow Kathleen Dean Moore at riverwalking.com. My thanks to Orion Magazine for this thoughtful interview. Be sure and visit them at orionmagazine.org.
Radio EcoShock.
We've heard the story of the river from Kathleen Dean Moore, but there's another river flowing over the world, and that's us. When I encounter a nexus of inquiring minds like Orion Magazine, I don't quit with the main article. It really pays to surf through the intelligent comments as well, and that's how I found our next guest. Tim Fox lives in Blue River, Oregon, in the Cascade Mountains, and he saw that other river. Tim, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
Well, in a moment, I'm going to ask you to tell us your vision in response to Kathleen Dean Moore, but first, why don't you describe where you live and how that shapes your own ecological consciousness?
Well, I live up in the Central Oregon Cascades on the west side of the mountains, which means the wet side, surrounded by Douglas fir, western hemlock, and red cedar forest. Much of it old growth. Just up the road from my house is a grove of old forest that the overstory trees date from the 16th century. So it's a very humbling experience to go out the front door and head up the road and jump into the woods and be walking around in trees that predate European contact in this area by 200 or 300, sometimes 400 years. Just gives you a different sense of things, and it's a quieting thing. I don't know how to describe it, but it's just humbling. And the river that I live on flows out of one of the largest wilderness areas in the state. So we have a lot of just wild country, and it really has informed my perspective on everything. I've lived here in this specific location since 1996, so almost 20 years. And I've lived in the Cascades since 90. So as the years go by, I just get more and more immersed and notice more and more details that inform me about my place here in the mountains, as well as the trees, the life. I worked as an owl biologist for a long time, so the owls have in particular really taught me a lot about not only the forest, but about my place here too. I seem to learn something new every day by being here.
I didn't know that you'd worked with the owls. They're pretty intelligent creatures, and they have a certain mystery for humans, I think, too.
Yeah, that's for sure. From what I understand anyway, is part of it is just that their faces, given their forward-facing eyes, their flat faces with eyes that face forward, they have binocular vision like we do, they look like people. And because their eyes are so big that the muscles that allow us to move our eyes around in our sockets, they can't do that. So they just have a piercing stare all the time because they have to move their entire heads if they want to see a new location. And so that gives them a penetrating gaze in and of itself that's just mesmerizing. And then the other aspect, too, is having worked with, in particular, spotted owls, and people probably are aware of the threat to the spotted owls that the incoming barred owl is being responsible for, most likely. The information looks like there's a very interesting owl soap opera going on out there right now where these two very closely related species that have been apart for a very long time are now coming back together and trying to figure out a new relationship, and it's playing out in a way that, if you look at it as a lesson for us, is very similar to humans' entry into the area and two different, very different cultures coming into contact and how they've interacted over the years as one is more aggressive and appears to be displacing the other. So it's an interesting comparison, analogy, that is playing out right here, and watching it over the last 25 years has really changed my perspective. At first, I was really bitter about the barred owls moving in, but now I see that in the larger ecological perspective, it seems like it's really an opportunity to look at an evolutionary event that we don't get to see very often, two closely related species coming together, and to look at the use of the spotted owl through the Endangered Species Act as this is how we're protecting the forests. And so as the potential for the spotted owl's struggle grows, it's really a call for us to look at protecting forests for their own sake so we don't hinge the fate of particularly the old growth ecosystem on a single bird, but instead protect the old growth ecosystem and then go in there with our human scientific curiosity and watch this evolutionary reunion as it unfolds.
And I completely agree. So look, in your comment at Orion Magazine, you write about a great river that few of us know about today, that it even existed. Would you mind just reading us out your idea?
Not at all. Just as a quick intro, when I read Kathleen's wonderful piece, I tried to imagine a river that would, of a suitable scale, to relate to her metaphor, and this is what came to mind. This is during the Pleistocene. There was a river containing 10 times the combined volume of all the rivers on Earth, and it thundered west from out of a place called Montana at speeds of upwards of 60 miles per hour, and as it tore across the Northwest to the Pacific Ocean. And this mightiest of rivers was born from the collapse of the glacial dam that had contained it as an enormous water body known as Lake Missoula. And no sooner had the dam burst than it began to reform again to repeat the cataclysm, likely hundreds of times until the final collapse spilled one last torrent into the warming world of the Holocene. It was this terminal river that came to mind as I read Kathleen's metaphor. By seeing her metaphor in relation to this Ice Age river, the reality of our present global predicament becomes clearer, as does the full spectrum of our essential work. The human equivalent of Lake Missoula began to grow 10,000 years ago behind a building ice dam of a new human story that had come to fill and chill the hearts of a swelling agricultural populace. Over the centuries, this story of exceptionalism and control grew and grew, and behind it the human waters rose. Strain built against the relentlessly expanding margins of this story until roughly two centuries ago, when the pressure became too great, and with industrial force, the dam burst. Unleashed, the industrial human flood swept across the earth, drowning everything in its path that would not or could not join the sweep. And the few generations born of the deluge during this relative geologic instant came to see it as normal. What's more, they came to depend on it for almost every facet of their existence and derive most of their physical sustenance, self-worth, meaning, purpose, social standing, and even identity from their contribution to its continuance. We who have inherited this aberrant normalcy and near total dependency can now see with unprecedented clarity the compounding and increasingly catastrophic planetary damage our flood has been causing by its very existence. And this vision has produced a heart-wrenching tension, too overwhelming for many of us to acknowledge. For those of us like Moore, who have the courage to do so, a vital aspect of the work such acknowledgement demands is, as she so beautifully describes, deflection, obstruction, and blockage of business as usual. But such work must be coupled with an awakening to the true nature of the river. Industrialized civilization is the river. We are the waters. Our story is the flood. This awareness leads to other work we must do if deflection, obstruction, and blockage are to become anything more than postponements of the total ecological erasure in which we are concurrently engaged in the day-to-day living of our lives as children of the flood. That other work is the conscious withdrawal of our personal and institutional energy from the torrent and the shifting of that energy into local communities integrated into local ecological networks where the fullness of human life may be met without involving the global industrial technological infrastructure with its insatiable demands for the unending and accelerating drawdown of planetary resilience. It's as simple and as difficult as promoting ways of human living where communication is direct eye-to-eye and voice-to-ear, where mobility is accomplished with feet, where the sources of food, water, shelter, and all the material necessities can be accessed by those feet, and where the stories, songs, and celebrations that matter most are those that bind us, our families, and communities to the land, which gives us our existence at every level, physical, emotional, and spiritual. And the time for this shift is now. Unlike the Tokleh, the Clark's Fork, the Columbia, the Mississippi, the Nile, the Yangtze, the Amazon, this flood-formed river of human excess, born from the exploitation in a mere two centuries, of the energy contained in fossil carbon deposits that took hundreds of millions of years to form, is and can only be temporary. The river will subside. The waters will diminish and settle back into well-worn channels carved by the solar-powered cycle of the seasons spinning their ceaseless rounds. And we will once again live with the trophic integrity that is our deepest birthright, our broadest tradition. Most importantly, our stories will frame this transformation to a stable state in terms of maturation rather than collapse, stagnation, regression, or a devolutionary going back. Thus, we will stop struggling at all costs to preserve a 10,000-year condition of arrested development, ceaseless adolescent growth, and embrace our long-postponed adulthood. In this effort, we have many examples from whom to learn. Those who long ago made the shift the citizens of the now global monoculture of industrial civilization must make. The following quote represents just one, offered by Jeanette Armstrong, an Okanagan from a land now called British Columbia. Quote, "I do know that people must come to community in the land. The transiency of peoples crisscrossing the land must halt, and people must commune together on the land to protect it and all our future generations. Self-sustaining indigenous people still on the land are already doing this. They present an opportunity to relearn and reinstitute the rights we all have as humans. As Okanagan, our most essential responsibility is to bond our whole individual and communal selves to the land. Many of our ceremonies have been constructed for this. We join with the larger self and with the land and rejoice in all that we are." Unquote. This is the essence of cultural maturation, and it is our most vital work, whether we're Okanagan or not. Committing to this work and making it the undercurrent of our every act is how the flood can end well. If the notion of the flood ending well arouses incredulity, recall that many of our most respected experts felt the same way about the prospects for life in the blast zone following the 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens. Some of them even anticipated a silent, barren grayscape for centuries to come, and they had the science to back them up. Yet, frog song and green shoots and purple lupin and the dark, loamy scrollwork of gopher tailings erupted from the ashen land almost immediately, shocking and awing the experts and the rest of us, perhaps even more profoundly than the eruption itself. Might life's response to our maturation prove equally shocking and awesome? There's only one way to find out, and the time of decision is upon us. Will we cling to the cresting wave of the familiar industrial story, despite ever more undeniable signs that it is about to break? Or will we engage with imaginative intention an opportunity that has not been available in 10,000 years, the opportunity to restore our waters to the long-abandoned channels of our humanity, and from there flow on, immersed in stories buoyed by a lasting river?
You've just heard a great story written as a blog comment from Tim Fox, writing in response to an article called The Rules of the River in Orion Magazine. You can find links to all that in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. So, Tim, do you think, you talk about localization, is it happening where you live, and is that partly why you choose to live there?
You know, it is happening. It's in fits and starts, and a lot of times it's almost that the ideas are happening, even though the actions aren't quite there yet in many instances. I get into conversations with locals about, you know, starting up a farmer's market here in the local community. And I think that at this point in the game, it seems like talking about the ideas is the stage that we're at in many instances, because the energy, it's kind of like I like to say, right now it's still easier to get in the car and drive 5 minutes to the mini mart to get a quart of milk than it is to go to your neighbor next door and trade eggs or something. Because we still have that fossil fuel infrastructure in place that makes things just very easy. So we're at a place that I think is maybe what James Howard Kunstler was talking about when he said, we need to make other arrangements. It's like we can start making the arrangements, but the enacting of those arrangements will be challenging until the momentum shifts and it actually becomes easier to walk next door and barter with your neighbor for a necessity than it is to drive down to the mini mart. Because once you say you think about the actual travel involved, 5 minutes drive to the mini mart turns into a 2-hour walk, and that becomes prohibitive. So it's easier when your neighbor's 5 minutes walk away to just do that. So these are the kinds of shifts that I think are just going to happen almost unconsciously as we see the transition out of this fossil fuel economy into something much more local. Is it's just going to become easier and easier to engage in these acts of sustenance with your neighbors than it will be to engage the giant corporate interests who are doing everything they can to substitute their globally produced products for the things that people and communities used to do for each other, and will, I think, pretty soon be doing again. And the trick is making the conceptual arrangements so that we're responsive to that and open to it and ready for it when the opportunity comes up, rather than feeling trapped or unprepared. It'll just be a natural shift.
Yeah, we moved to a walkable community, and that means everything around us is, we can walk to it. And at first, as you say, it's almost like making your life a little bit more difficult to think about growing your own food, for example. I look at my carrots, and I'm very proud of them, but I have to say I can buy tons of carrots cheaper probably than I produce those. And yet, I like my carrots better, and it gives me confidence that even as the price of food keeps going up due to climate change and other reasons, we'll be able to feed ourselves into our old age if we learn those basic skills.
Right.
Yeah. And I wanted to talk to you too. You know, this is something that's bugging me, so I'm just picking you as my victim for ecotherapy here. But, you know, the polar vortex is sweeping through much of North America right now, and the whole climate movement seems to go dormant with it. I feel it's hard for me to put out a show about climate change because people are going, oh, warm, that sounds good, you know. And the people don't know that the ocean off New England is 5 degrees above normal, so hot it's threatening species there with extinction. They don't know Alaska and Greenland are still way above normal. They don't know Australia's been roasting again. You know, South Australia just had the driest October on record, and that's a pretty dry place, but who cares? It's really cold outside, so there isn't any global warming. Do you have any thought on how we can keep the climate movement conscious through the winter in the Northern Hemisphere?
Well, that's a big challenge because we're definitely, I think, just by nature, very attuned to what we experience. And that's that kind of gets to one of the, I think, the big issues is the challenges we face are challenges that are deeper than any one person's experience, but yet we all have to respond to them. And I think maybe that comes back to the importance of the story. Having a story that allows us to keep these things in mind, even when our experience in the day-to-day isn't necessarily connected to them, like the information you just conveyed. You know, the story would talk about the dry conditions in Australia and the melting ice up in the north. That's what was so nice about Kathy's piece, is her experience. She actually was in a place where her experience was then conveyed through her story, puts us there in this Alaskan landscape that we think of as cold, and she shows us it's 93 degrees. And so we can get it through her story, and even if it's not jiving with our experience, the anomaly of that still, I think, comes through. So figuring out how to frame our stories about our place, like seeing this Arctic cold as something that's an aberration, that seems like that's the job of our story to tell us, yeah, this is part of climate change. It's not necessarily going to warm everything up. It's going to make everything more unstable. And we're going to get Arctic blasts coming down and superstorms off the coast and islands being wiped out by hurricanes and things like that. That's the stuff that the story has to keep alive, even if our experiences aren't. And with the accessibility at this moment of a communication system that's instant and global, we have the opportunity to use it to make this big story available in a lot of ways that wasn't possible in the past and very probably won't be possible much longer into the future. But I think if we use it right now to its maximum effect, it'll help ease the transition and keep us aware of the bigger globe that we're a part of in all of its problems, even if right now it's sunny and beautiful where you happen to be. Keeps it all in perspective.
Well, I think that's what I'm trying to do with Radio EcoShock as well. It's been a pleasure talking with you, Tim, and we have been talking with writer Tim Fox, as found in his excellent comment in Orion Magazine's blog. You can find links to that magazine, to our previous talk by Kathleen Dean Moore, and another article by Tim Fox in Dark Mountain Issue 5, all in my weekly Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. Be sure and check that out. Tim, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Alex.
That's it for our time together this week. Our website is ecoshock.org. Find us on SoundCloud. Get links for this program in the show blog at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith, saying thank you for listening and caring about your world.